You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
We're back, people.
I mean, where did we go?
Speaking of back, we're going way back.
I mean, not that far back.
Back to the 80s.
I mean, which you think about it, that was a really long time ago. Hell, last week was a long time ago, let's just face it.
But first, before we get into that, what are we smoking this week, Brad?
We are smoking the Punch Signature. And, you know, this is a cigar now that, you know, I had a few I really enjoyed, and I've now kind of been my everyday go-to, you know, when I make a box purchase. You know, this is a well-crafted cigar, definitely full-bodied. This has features a Ecuadorian, the Corojo wrapper. And then, you know, one of the interesting things is it's grown in the Los Rios province of Ecuador between two volcanic mountains. And it features both Nicaraguan and Dominican long fillers. And I got to say, with the flavor profile here, it's complex, it's leathery, it's, you know, got a little bit of a woody taste, and it's just everything that I look for in a cigar. And, you know, this is priced relatively inexpensive, which made it an even bigger bonus.
Yeah, this is the latest cigar from Punch. And, you know, I've had a few of their other lines, but this right here is definitely a nice full-bodied, full-strength cigar. It's definitely got a little bit of a punch to it, pun intended. I mean, I would kind of compare this to the Punch Uppercut, which was that was a pretty good cigar as well. That had a little bit more strength to it, but this one's a nice blend of strength and flavor, and it's kind of become my go-to cigar lately.
Of course, it's stocked in my humidor. And especially now that we get ready for, you know, the steampunk shenanigans and everything else, I think you find yourself here more than what you do at your own house these days.
It's boring at my house.
Yes. Here as well, without my good friends surrounding me.
But yeah, this week's topic on hand, we're kind of talking about the genre of detective TV shows, and none of it was as popular as it was in the 1980s. It was kind of the heyday of the private investigator TV show. So we're going to jump in our DeLorean and go back to the 80s and do some investigating of the topic of private investigators.
Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. We're talking about detective fiction today, maybe a specific subgenre of that, of the private investigator story. Anyone not familiar with what a private investigator is, that's someone who does not work for a police department or whatever. They're a private individual who is hired to do investigations, you know, kind of as a private corporation thing.
Yeah, and it's, you know, specifically we're going to focus on, you know, the private investigators of the 80s. And, you know, with this, it was always kind of like the people that you wouldn't think would fit into that typical cop mold. You know,
that's the best thing about private investigators. But before we even get into the heyday of or at least detective television of the 80s, freaking the detective genre has been around since... Well, since before TV. I mean, it's probably one of the oldest stories. You know, consider the first, you know, kind of detective story was actually published by Voltaire in 1748, a book called Zadig. I guess I'm even close to pronouncing that right. And the one who kind of is credited with creating the first fictional detective is Edgar Allan Poe in Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Yeah, EAP in the house, yo. Shout out to MC Lars.
Augustine Dupin was his character's name. But yeah, a lot of the rules that apply to modern detective story is stuff that Poe actually kind of created. He described as the primary concern of the plot of a detective novel is ascertaining the truth at the... ascertaining the truth, and it's usually obtained by a complex system of intellectual logic, astute observation, and precipitous inference. Basically, you know, it's a whodunit. The audience doesn't know who the killer is. You know, the detective in the story doesn't know who the killer is. And we follow that journey of him trying to solve a crime. Or you get the, what they call the reverse detective, where it's, we all know who the killer is from the beginning, and it's watching how they get caught. You know, it's like, you know, how are the other people in the story going to find out what you already know? But for the most part, it's the traditional whodunit.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, I mean, I think that's one of the things that really sparked, you know, the entire whole murder mystery, you know, like game franchises and stuff to that extent, too.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's something probably everyone's favorite novels is some kind of whodunit. I mean, going even way back to, you know, Agatha Christie's probably one of the biggest known detective writers back in the day. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and, you know, Sherlock Holmes. I mean, Sherlock Holmes is probably one of my favorite books growing up. I've read all of the Holmes stories.
Yeah, and I mean, it's... like you said, you know, the books, I mean, there's so much detail, there's so much depth and character building and everything else that, you know, the books oftentimes bring so much more because you're able to use your imagination and your influence more so than what a linear, you know, seeing it on a television screen will, because it takes, you know, a whole lot of that mystique away.
That and the thing, too, I think makes... because, you know, there is another subset of the detective drama, which they call the police procedural shows. It's your stuff like your NCIS, your CSI, your Law and Order, which has become more popular today. We don't really have a whole lot of detective shows anymore. It's all gone to, like, the police genre. But with the private investigator, there's so much more freedom for that character because in a traditional police story... they're limited by the law. Like, you know, the cop, unless it's some kind of rogue cop story, can't go too far outside of the law. You know, they have to deal with constitutional rights and freaking search warrants and all that other shit. But a detective doesn't, you know, he's a private citizen. He doesn't have to worry about all those. He doesn't have to have probable cause. You know, he can kick in somebody's door and slap a confession out of somebody or whatever. So there was a lot more gray area to the detective novels, which always made those characters more interesting to read and more interesting to watch.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it brought such a different dynamic. You know, like you said, with operating with inside the law, but, you know, these were kind of, you know, in some instances, a, you know, private detective, you know, may not necessarily be necessarily a good civilian, you know, a good person, you know. I mean, they might have that, you know, bad boy image that just happens to, you know.
And for the most part, these guys are trying to do good. You know, they're, you know, at the end of the episode or the end of the story, there's usually kind of some kind of justice served. But, yeah, there's, they don't have to be as nice about it as traditional
police. No, they're not running around in, you know, suits and badges and everything. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
it's like whatever in the Samuel Jackson said in the whatever Shaft movie, like when because he starts off as a police officer and then gives up his badge to become a private investigator, and some guy's like, "Man, you ain't a cop no more." And he's like, "You ask yourself one question: does that make me more dangerous or less dangerous?"
I mean, that's a good quandary. I mean,
yeah,
but I don't know. I mean, you know that.
They play by their own rules.
I mean, and I can get behind that 100%. I mean, I'm kind of that way myself. I operate by my own book, whatever that code is. I don't know. It might be ever-changing.
The private detectives of old were the, you know, Avengers. they were the comic book heroes before there were comic book heroes. I mean, some of the first things Marvel produced before they got into the superhero genre was true crime and detective stories. I mean, hell, Batman is like probably one of the greatest, you know, he's like a modern day Sherlock Holmes, you know, wrapped in a superhero persona, but.
And a lot more gizmos and gadgets.
Oh, yeah. He's like James Bond and Sherlock Holmes combined.
I mean, I think that's a good synopsis there.
But, like I said, and also it's the detective genre. Like I said, we're going to kind of focus on the 80s because to me that's the heyday of the private investigator show. But I found this website that was, I think it was like Thrilling Detective or something. Let me find it again. But it, yeah, thrillingdetective.com. And they have a list of TV detective shows from the very beginning up to now. And some of the first shows were, you know, on the air in like 1949 was the first one they have listed as a detective show. And like I said, in it, you know. There's like, you know, there was always at least two or three a year on, and then like I said, once you get into the 80s, early 90s, it just kind of exploded. Where
yeah, absolutely. I don't know what do you think led to that explosion? I look at shows more modern today, and I'm like, you know, I watch a lot of them for not necessarily the storyline, but you know, a lot of the science and a lot of the, you know, kind of futuristic technology that goes into it. But with the private detective stuff, like, you know, for me, I think it was almost like rooting for the underdog.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even in like, you know, 80s cinema, there's seems to be way more, you know, action-oriented stuff on TV or in, you know, movies back then. And I think the detective genre is just something that was... It was at a time where special effects weren't the greatest, so you couldn't have, like, you know, big-budget sci-fi stuff like you do today. And a detective story was relatively cheap to produce. I mean, it's just a story of a guy trying to solve a crime. I mean, and it's...
And you don't even need real police cars.
Yeah. And like I said, you could, like, it's cheap to film a bunch of action sequences with no CGI and stuff. And, you know, the stories were compelling. But then also it was... You could jump... Like, today, most things have a story arc, where if you don't catch from the beginning, you may not understand what's going on. But, and that's why I think the police procedural dramas are so big today, is because you can jump in anywhere, and it, you know, it's a self-contained story. They may be some kind of slight story arc for the season, but really, like I said, you know, a lot of it is just the case of the week. Yeah, you know, same thing with the detective stuff, where it's like, you know, you don't have to watch them in order. You can just jump in anytime. You know, it's short attention span theater.
I mean, which, I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm a lot busier now in life than what I used to be. So I find myself now, like, shows that, you know, rely so heavily on following every single episode, you know, I'm finding myself having to pull away just because I don't have the time to watch that much TV anymore.
Especially with a lot of the new stuff coming out. I mean, if I don't catch it from episode one, I won't watch it until it hits Netflix or Hulu or something where I can start from the beginning, because you jump in the middle of the story, you don't know what the hell's going on because each episode is really link to the last episode. And I think we can't really even talk about the 80s detective genres without talking about, probably two of the biggest names, Stephen J. Cannell and Donald P. Belisario. Like, these are the guys that produced most of your childhood 80s action TV shows. I mean, Stephen is the one that came up with the A-Team. I mean, the A-Team, Airwolf was a Belisario. Like, both of those guys are known for the detective genre. And even, the police drama, too, was a big one with Belisario. I mean, he was responsible for JAG and freaking NCIS and all the NCIS spinoffs. Yes. But like I said, I don't know how many times growing up watching different, 80s TV shows that I saw that, little animation at the end of, dude typing on a typewriter, pulling it out, and it lands in, a pile of papers that turns into a C. That was, the famous Stephen J. Cannell ending that was tagged on, every episode of, A-Team, Knight Rider, whatever.
I mean, that's probably one of the biggest things that I remember. I don't know. I mean, it was the 80s, and, I guess one of the other underlying themes would be you're guaranteed either some sweet chops, a sweet mustache, jewelry, badass hats, or boots. That was kind of your, P.I., dress code, I guess.
Speaking of sweet mustaches, let's jump right into pretty much the first detective show of the 80s, Magnum P.I. Started in 1980 and ran for till 1988. I mean, every dude wanted to be... I blame Tom Selleck for the 80s mustache. you weren't a man until you had a mustache. At that time, it was not ironic. You did not... It was before, porn ruined it. And, everyone's you have a creeper porn mustache, and you had to shave that shit in the 90s. But in the 80s, it was cool to have a porn mustache.
Well, I mean, I think we saw a little bit of a resurgence. I mean, you had modern TV shows, Family Guy, The Simpsons. I mean, all doing, plays based specifically on Tom, Selleck's mustache.
I think I saw a sketch when it was a guy grew a mustache, but the mustache was some kind of parasitic organism, and it started talking to him and stuff, and he was being controlled by the mustache.
Sounds like some Aqua Teen Hunger Force shit.
It probably was. I see a lot of late night TV and fall down some YouTube holes, so I may be this may be a fever dream that I'm imagining, but I remember seeing something one time where a guy was being controlled by his mustache.
Yeah, I mean, Magnum P.I. was just, absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it was ranked, in the top 20 U.S. television programs during the first 5 years that the series was broadcast in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, this was a time when there was no YouTube, no internet. So this was probably some people's first exposure to Hawaii. I mean, not only was the stories compelling, but the scenery was just so beautiful that it was people's hour-long vacation or 30-minute vacation, once a week. Well, hey, we can go see what's hanging out, down in my, Hawaii and see Magnum driving around in his badass Ferrari into shit.
I don't know. I mean, I think the scenery definitely adds a nostalgia. I mean, Hawaii is still, one of those premier destination places that people are like, oh, I absolutely have to go. I don't know. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that Lord of the Rings, and Avatar and, some of these big budget films have been successful is just the level of scenery and stuff that they brought to the table.
Oh, yeah. That's why so many, said Lost and even the new version of Hawaii 5.0, still films in Hawaii because it's just, it's a movie set pretty much. It's you can't recreate, how beautiful, the... the Hawaiian countryside is. And I said, Magnum P.I. was a story of a detective, ex-Navy intelligence guy who basically the story was very rough that apparently he worked for this famous author at some point or saved him or something. So the guy kind of owed him a favor and let him live in his huge, 200-acre amazing, estate as, the quote-unquote security guy. And he pretty much operated his private investigation business out of this guy's guest house. But you never see the dude through the whole episode. He's always gone off somewhere writing his next big novel. I think they actually had his voice on there like three or four times in the series, and it was always voiced by Orson Welles. Was the voice of the Robin Masters, the guy who owned the estate Magnum lived in. And it was kind of like a weird Odd Couple type show too, because he was always Magnum and the butler caretaker of the estate, Higgins. and Higgins is this ex-British sergeant major who is very by the book uptight guy, who kind of looks down as thinks Magnum's a scumbag, but eventually they learn to respect and deal with each other, but it always added a cool comedic element to to the stories.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder, with this series, if it's one of the, he always had his two freaking Doberman Pinschers with him, and I'm wondering, as far as the bully breeds and stuff like that. Like you hear a lot about pit bulls today and stuff. You don't hear about the Dobermans, the German Shepherds.
The day, it was the Dobermans and the Rottweilers were the pit bulls of the 80s.
Yes.
And freaking Malinois. Those things are fucking crazy. Yeah. And, he also had his two sidekicks, TC, played by Roger Masary. I forgot. I can't read my own handwriting. And Rick, played by Larry... I can't even read today. But anyway, like I said, because it's Hawaii. You can't, there's no like highway. Or they may be connecting the islands. So if you want to go from island to island, you need a dude with a helicopter. So there was always some reason for him to talk TC into letting him, flying him around the islands. Because TC owned like a helicopter tour company. And, Rick owned a bar. So he kind of connected with the criminal elements a little bit, so you always had him kind of as his informant or guy that could, everyone talks to a bartender, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think that was one of the things that I really enjoyed about Magnum PI is, I don't know, I mean, I remember from my HR training back when I was like 18 or, whatever the case was, quid pro quo, this for that, and, Magnum really has that, like, I'll do this for you, but you're going to have to do, this for me. And there was always that kind of give and take, no matter what the, the scenario was.
Yeah, Higgins always trying to get him to do something, threatening to take away the Ferrari.
And I don't know. I mean, dude, that was a fucking sweet car, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was a
308 GTS.
Roger Mosley and Larry Minetti is the names I cannot pronounce.
Sound like two gangster ass motherfuckers.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm talking old school gangster. Not like Blood and Crypt gangster.
Oh. I'd say, speaking of the Odd Couple relationship between Magnum and Higgins, another great, one of my favorite detective shows, which, almost got canceled in its first year until they moved it where it was coming on after, Magnum, and that kind of boosted its ratings and made it popular, was Simon and Simon, which ran from 81 to 89. And it was pretty much the Odd Couple added with the detective story, because it was about two brothers. One of them, Rick, was played by Gerald McCraney, who is still today in like a lot of movies and TV shows. One of my favorite actors, as a hardcore, he was the ex-Marine Vietnam vet, who was still kind of like a roughneck dude, smoked cigars, drank, and his brother AJ, who was played by James Parker, who was the super 80s, uptight guy that, liked, wine and fancy things. And basically Rick lived in a boat parked in his brother's yard, and they had this detective company together. So like his brother's like this high class dude, and Rick is this like freaking street level, ex-military guy. So they, constantly got into each other's nerves, but, they came together to solve crimes and get into shit.
Yeah. And I don't know, man. I mean, in between Magnum PI and then Simon and Simon, I mean, I think CBS hit a gold mine with these.
Oh, yeah. Like, so cheap to produce and were insanely popular. And that's another thing with these 80s dramas, too. It's almost like, the cars they drive were important characters. Because, you know, Magnum had his Ferrari, and then Simon & Simon, Rick always had this old Dodge Power Wagon with this giant, like, steel plate bumper that you could just run over anything, and which kind of went with his personality of being the kind of the rough dude, too. And then his brother, who always drove, like, he started off with a, like, fully restored 57 Chevy convertible, and then eventually upgraded to a Camaro RS.
Well, I mean, that's, I mean, I think that
the fancy guy versus the rough guy
brings up a very valid point. I mean, you know, I know the ESO guys already did the geek vehicle episode, but I mean, you know, the cars in these TV series are just as memorable as the actors and the characters they portrayed.
Yeah, and they were even like, even their choice of gun, too, was always, like I said, Rick carried a big-ass 44 Magnum, and his brother had, like, kind of a smaller 357. It was like, yeah. it's like everything they did was kind of match. And I remember there's, like, one episode that it's probably the first time I've ever seen drinking save someone's life. I was like, that's why I'm going to be a drunk.
That's going to be my goal in life.
Because it was like
thanks, TV.
It was like a weird two-part episode where they found, like, kind of, I think, one of them got like a job offer or something, and they finally like decided they were just going to like had enough of each other, and they were going to, you know, separate and, you know, kind of close the company. But they went out for one last drink, and one last drink turns into like 20 last drinks, and they're both stumbling back to the house like hammered drunk, having to hold each other up. And as soon as they walk into the house, some dude comes up and just unloads on the back door with a freaking machine gun. Well, it turns out they're both so drunk, as soon as they walked in the house, they tripped and fell on the floor, so they got missed by the shooting. So I'm like, being drunk can save your life if someone's trying to shoot you in the back.
I think Boondock Saints might have ripped that off.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably was one of my favorite 80s detective shows. I wanted that truck.
Dude, I still want that truck. The Power Wagon was badass. I don't know. You had the dull paint job, so it looked ratty. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know. I mean, one of the things is, you know, the episode where they actually use the freaking metal bumper and end up crushing a car's engine or some shit. I was just like, that's so unrealistic, but that was awesome.
And another thing of these detective shows, they always have their police liaison guy that they have to go, you know, when they need to turn something over to the real authorities or they need some kind of information. And probably the best version of that is, you know, Downtown Brown, who was their kind of streetwise detective that they always had to go, you know, sucker into helping them in some way or getting them out of trouble when they got arrested for doing something dumb on an investigation. Played by Tim Reed, who has been in a lot of shows, but Downtown Brown was always hilarious. They would always go to like ask him for help when he's like undercover somewhere, and then they have to like they like threaten to blow his cover, you know, or draw attention to him until he helps them. You know, they always like had to con him into helping him in some way, and
like this is really to benefit you more than it is to benefit us.
Or to bail them out when they got, you know, break into somebody's house to get evidence and ends up getting arrested or getting into some kind of bar fight with somebody. You know, those dudes got arrested a lot for being that. They were lucky they had a cop friend to get them out of trouble.
I mean, you always need somebody that can, you know, vouch and pull some strings. I mean, I don't know. I don't think you can be a, you know, a private investigator, detective or anything without having that leverage.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a private detective until I looked into it and was like, no, it's a lot of boring sitting in a car watching people. Like, there's no, like, action. Like, most of them don't even carry guns. I'm like, it was nothing like the 80s lied to me. I thought it was, like, you know, a badass adventure. Then I'm like, nope, that's all fictional.
And then we got police procedural videos to turn everybody around and be like, this is what it's more going to be like.
I think that's what about a bit, because, I mean, It really died out in the mid-90s. There's not really a currently on TV anything I would consider a private investigator show.
No, I mean, I've heard, you know, and, you know, some folks reference, you know, maybe a Constantine or something like that potentially. But even then, like, I mean, it's a gray area. Like, yeah, I mean, it definitely doesn't tie into the...
I might say Supernatural kind of falls into that category, because they're, you know, but instead of, like, crimes, they're fighting monsters. Burn Notice a few years ago would probably kind of fall into that genre, and, you know, they've kind of started heading that way with Castle, because, like I said, he's kind of gone out of working directly with the police and started his private investigation firm, so... I mean, that's probably about the only thing on TV right now that I would say is almost a true private investigator show. But yet, it kind of, you know, that kind of died out in the 90s, and we now have like a crap load of police procedural shows. You know, there's like five CSIs and like six NCISs and like a half dozen, whatever, Law and Orders.
I don't know. I can't even... There's so many out there, I can't even follow anymore.
So is there, like, you know, I know you didn't watch as much of much TV as I did in the 80s, because you're a little bit younger, but is there anything, like, a favorite you have that you can remember?
I mean, my favorite we haven't talked about yet.
Bring it up, let's talk
about it. You know, my favorite from the 80s was the A-Team. I mean, that's... Yeah, I mean, you know, it had the awesome theme, you know, they had the freaking... A-Team van, and I am so pissed that, you know, I've got a collection of, you know,
there's iconic... There's nobody making a current A-Team model.
You know, and the one I did have ordered or something to that extent, like, turned out to be a fake or a fraud or something anyway. Like, that fell through. So, you know, I mean, I would love to be able to add an A-Team van to my model car collection.
Yeah, there was definitely some shows that kind of... push the edge of the private detective genre but A-Team is definitely, I think, qualifies for that. Cause I mean, it's about four guys that, you know, basically mercenaries that, you know, may not be trying to solve crimes, but they're basically heroes for hire, kind of like, you know, Luke Cage and Iron Fist. But, you know, they were a bunch of Vietnam vets that were framed for a crime they didn't commit. And so they escaped and became, you know, soldiers of fortune, but since they were good guys, they weren't, you know, mercenaries. They was like, oh, there's biker gangs harassing my business. Let's hire the A-Team to screw them up.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, I mean, I just, you know...
Again, a vehicle being an integral part of the show. For guys that are on the run, they never switch cars. They always drive that van. You think that, you know, someone would be like, let's put an APB out on that van. But no, you do not mess the BA's van.
But I don't know. You know, for some reason, Mr. T always stands out in my mind when, you know, we bring up this genre or people start talking about, you know,
BA 80s. BA Baracus.
You know, I mean, that's just, I mean, it's iconic. I don't know. You know, for me, it's almost like a... you know, a throwback to the Mad Max or, you know, the Mission Impossibles or something. So it's just, for me, that's the nostalgia and that's what I remember.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and for a cigar nerd, too, Hannibal is like one of my, you know, role models. Because the dude always, like, you know, you always get that line of, you know, him pulling out a cigar, lighting it up and going, I love it when a plan comes together.
I mean... That's right up my alley. I mean, I don't know. You know, maybe that's... I saw, you know, Hannibal over there, you know, smoking his cigars and stuff like that. So, when I grow up, I'm going to smoke cigars and I'm going to have a catchy phrase.
Yeah. Hannibal played by George Peppard, face man, who was the con man of the team, who always got the equipment they needed, played by Dirk Benedict, who's, of course, from Battlestar Galactica, the original Starbuck. Mr. T, we've already talked about, and Dwight Schultz, who's done a lot of stuff on Star Trek too. I mean, that guy's still very active. Murdoch, the helicopter pilot, who was insane. And so every episode when they go, because he's the only one that's not actually wanted by the government, because he's insane. So so each episode they have to go bust him out of the insane asylum. And, you know, some of the worst security in TV history in this, because there was, like, always a different con of how we're going to get Murdoch out of the insane asylum each week. And then you had BA that was the, you know, ranger who was afraid of flying, so they always had to you know, put some kind of Mickey in his milk to knock him out when they had to fly somewhere. So, and that was one thing I thought it was cool when they did the A-Team movie, was the fact that they kind of explained why he was afraid of flying because he almost fell out of a helicopter. That was one thing that never made sense. Why is a freaking airborne ranger afraid to fly?
Yeah, you know, it was just one of the, this doesn't add up here.
That was one of my favorite things of the new A-Team movie, was the fact that they explained his fear of flying.
Yeah, and, you know, for folks that haven't seen the movie or whatever, I think that came out, what, 2010?
Something like that.
So,
yeah, Liam Neeson does a perfect Hannibal. I mean, even that, like, opening sequence, he's wearing the... Because Hannibal, you'd always see him half the time in a blue shirt with khakis. And, like, so that's how the movie starts, with him in the traditional Hannibal get-up, smoking his cigar and getting into shit.
Yeah. Ain't getting on no plane.
And some of the, because I mean, it was TV of the 80s, so you couldn't show anybody actually getting killed. So they would come up with the most elaborate plans and blow up all kind of stuff and shoot so many guns, and one ever got killed.
I mean, I think that was one of the beauties of the show.
It was like live action G.I. Joe. No one ever got hurt.
The violence was so over the top, but there were never any casualties or, you know, like serious injuries or anything that would...
The stuntmen are the absolute heroes of that TV show. I mean, that show would not have been, you know, as great as it was without the stunt team on it. Because, I mean, you would see them flip a car five times and everyone get out like woozy. Like, no one ever got injured. No one ever got hurt. Like, and the those Ruger Mini 14 rifles, I always wanted one of those.
Put that on your bucket list.
Yeah, because I've seen a lot of those rifles, but I've never seen the A-Team version with the folding stock. I've never been able to find one of those.
Yeah, and I don't know. You know, I mean, you know, there was a Yahoo poll that, you know, amongst 1,000 television viewers that, you know, the A-Team was one of the films that everybody, or one of the series that everybody said they would like to see revived.
Yeah, I mean, that's... You know, like a modern-day version of the A-Team, it would probably, you know, still work today.
No, if
they did it true to the original.
I think it would. I don't know. I mean, this might be a good opportunity to segue, because there were two other films, The Dukes of Hazzard, which doesn't fly, but, you know, the second was Knight Rider.
Yeah, I mean, Knight Rider's, that kind of pushes it to the edge of the
gray probably, level. But.
Yeah, but yeah, and another thing where the car is the star. But yeah, But Knight Rider is, like I said, probably another thing when you know, don't hassle the Hoff. But I mean, that made, you know, that's
the
where
Hoff 9000,
where David Hasselhoff, you know, became famous. Is, you know, everyone, you know, loves Knight Rider, and they made a couple like TV movies.
He was famous before Baywatch and the slow motion running.
Yeah, this will happen before Baywatch. But speaking of Baywatch, there was a detective series spinoff called Baywatch Nights, where Hasselhoff was a private investigator at night after he finished his shift on the beach. It was kind of like dark and weird. It was so weird in contrast to like Baywatch. I think it only lasted like a season or two, but it was the weirdest thing.
Just...
And it was on TV at the same time that Baywatch was, so he'd be like, you know, rescuing people on the beach during the daytime, and then at night he'd be out solving crimes.
12 hours later, solving crimes.
Yeah, I don't know when that dude slept.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm wondering. I'm like, wait a second, so he's doing a 12-hour like, I don't know.
Yeah, the Foundation for Law and Government, Michael Knight and his trusty sidekick, Kit, which what's kind of funny is now... A lot of the technology from that show is becoming real. I mean, you've got the Apple Watches that are voice activated, and you know the Samsung watches, so you can actually talk into your watch now, just like Michael always. That's how he always called Kit and stuff, was on his wrist communicator. And they're self-driving cars now. I mean, they're not, you know, fully in the market yet, but that's something that's will be an everyday thing coming up soon. I mean, if it can talk to me like Kit, I'm sold.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I mean, I think for me, you know, this is, you know, the show that put the Pontiac Firebird on the map. Yeah. I mean, like, as a you know, kid growing up, it was like, oh, I'm going to have one of those cars.
A modernized version of Dukes of Hazzard, because they always had a reason to jump the General Lee, and Michael always, for some reason, you know, every episode, he had to do at least one turbo boost. That was, like, probably in the contract, that, like, once per episode, we got to show him jumping that car.
I mean, there's just a good filling. And if you've never been in a car airborne while you're in control, not like crashing or something, I mean, it is the filling that you're on top of the world. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to see somebody edit in like Knight Rider and add the General Lee horn every time he does a turbo boost. Jump it, kid.
Oh my god.
I mean, that made the members only jacket like, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. You know, I was late to the members only jacket club, but man, I was repping that thing all throughout elementary school. And I think even into high school, because it kind of had that resurgence factor. And
speaking of stuff they tried to bring back, yeah, that Knight Rider TV series, that second Knight Rider TV series they tried to make like several years ago was horrible. Because Kit was a Mustang. Kit should not be a freaking Mustang.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, it spun off a few video games on some of the older game consoles, and I can't ever say that those were very great either.
Like, not only was it was Kit and Mustang, he was voiced by Val Kilmer, and he had like it could morph and stuff, so it could turn into like a big jacked up truck if they needed to do some off roading stuff, or yeah, it was just. I think at one point even turned into a robot at one point. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
If Michael Bay ever got a hold of the rights to, you know, Kit or something, that's what you would have. Like, well, I've directed 17 Transformer cars. This car can transform. Like, no, Kit should not transform.
But yeah, speaking of another show that was made by its stunt drivers and stuff, one of my favorites was a show actually about a stunt driver. And The Fall Guy, played by Lee Majors, featuring Douglas Barr and Heather Thomas, one of the hottest chicks from the 80s. It was all about a team of stuntmen who would, you know, when they're between movies or whatever, would operate as bounty hunters for like a Bond company. They were like, you know, people who jumped.
That's the only reason you just like it, for the blonde hair, big boobs, and the bounty hunter.
Yeah. And, you know, Lee Majors, he's like, he had this, speaking of vehicles, he had this big jacked up GMC truck with like a big like eagle on the hood, who would do the most craziest stunts with it. And like I said, they would pretty much, you know, chase down, they were bounty hunters, that, you know, stuntmen by day, bounty hunters by night. And you know, the show always started with them rehearsing or filming some kind of big stunt sequence, usually with some like weird car tricks. And then, you know, after they got done, you know, they would, you know, someone would give them a job, and then they would go off and hunt down whoever. And usually whatever stunt they were rehearsing at the, you know, at the show, at the start of the show, would somehow, you know, they would have to use that stunt that they had practiced to end up catching the bad guy, or, you know, whatever scheme that was going on that week.
Well, I was just glancing through the Wikipedia article, and it's funny that you brought up the truck, because there is an entire section of Wikipedia that, you know, talks exactly about the equipment package, the tire size, the tire type, the whole nine yards. So, you know, if you could get a hold of a 1980 GMC K25 wide side with a High Sierra equipment level package.
Dude, I've looked for one. I mean, they'd always jump that truck, do all kind of crazy stunts in that thing. Yeah, and that was another one where Lee Majors was always, you know, blazing a cigar in that show at least once an episode. So, you know, goes back to the cigar nerd thing. Yes.
Got to work in the cigars, you know, to the theme. That's very important.
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of a modern-day cowboy, too. I mean, he, you know, when he wasn't, you know, on a set somewhere, he had this, like, cabin just out in the middle of nowhere that was their home base. And, like I said, it was a place I wanted to live. I mean, his cabin was badass.
I mean, I know where we can find you a cabin. I don't know about the truck yet, because I haven't looked. Might need some work, but I think we can make it happen.
Look on Craigslist to see if we... Yeah. I mean, like I said, watching this show, too, because it was... I always wanted to be a stuntman, like, after watching the show growing up. But then again, yeah, I got fat, and there's, you know, not really very much call for, like, fat stunt doubles. You know, the fat guys usually don't get any cool stunt work in the movies.
Why is that?
I don't know. Fat guys are hard to kidnap.
So it's a safety thing.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I guess I could go, I'm growing the beard. I guess I could go be Kevin Smith's stunt double now. But other than that, I got to get back in shape if I want to be a stuntman.
Yeah, that was one of the things that, you know, was always kind of, if I could, like, I've always wanted to just kind of do that, you know, be able to, jump a car through flames or, you know, do the crazy spin outs and the car crashes and stuff. I always seemed like that would be fun in a controlled environment.
Yeah. Lee Major's name in the show was Colt Seavers, which was like a badass name. And then his Howie Munson was his like nephew or cousin or something who was like, you know, a college kid who decided he wanted to come join the family business, and much to Colt's chagrin, it pretty much, you know, called him kid through the whole series. That's yeah, because pretty much he was the freaking proverbial rookie through the whole thing. And Jody Banks, played by Heather Thomas, which was. Usually, like, for some reason, they would. She had to be in a bikini once per episode. I think that was also in the contract.
I mean, I'm not going to say, you know, the appeal absolutely sells. I mean.
Oh, yeah, man, it was the 80s.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it was her for this, and, you know, later on, Pamela Anderson was on the stage. I mean.
Yeah, it ran from 81 to 86. And speaking of another 80s person, the girl who was Terry was the one that would always give them their missions or whatever, played by Marky Post from Night Court.
Huh. Interesting.
But yeah, like a freaking, that GMC truck was, like, I think I still have a couple Hot Wheels. Like, if I dig into my, you know, basement, a Hot Wheels version of that truck.
Yeah, and it looks like, you know, this, the first season of Fall Guy actually got a DVD release in June of 2007?
Something like that. But a lot of these shows are so old now that there's a lot of episodes of Simon and Simon and Fall Guy on YouTube. I think even Magnum's on there. If you can't find them on Netflix, Hulu, or Amazon, a lot of that stuff you can find on YouTube if you want to go back and check it out. Like, I fell down a YouTube hole hard when I was researching this episode, and I found this playlist of this guitarist doing covers of 80s TV show themes, like metal versions of 80s TV show themes, and I listened to that thing for hours. We posted a link to it on our Facebook page. Go check it out. Like, definitely give that guy some props, because it's amazing. It sucked me down the nostalgia hole so hard.
And I don't know, you know, for me, it's... I missed out on a lot of this stuff, and I'm finding myself gravitating back to it. I don't know. I got a retro soul, I guess. I don't know. I like old school video games and the TV shows and stuff. So
yeah, there's,
it was a much simpler time.
There's few things from the 80s that you remember fondly, and then you go back and look at it today, and you're like, they do not hold up. But a lot of these, you know, old detective shows, I could watch them if they were on TV today. Like, so I've gone back.
Well,
and
I mean,
watched
I was watching, you know, Simon and Simon doing earlier, some research and. You know, I was like, "Hey, I'm into this. I'm digging it. It's not bad."
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love the 80s action TV shows, and we were kind of talking about some things that push the limit of the. Oh, before we get into that, MacGyver.
I mean, I think you gotta talk about MacGyver, and then I think also too, Riptide is worth, you know.
That's one of the 80s shows no one but me remembers. Like, I rarely hear anyone bring up Riptide. It was about three former naval guys who became private investigators in some, I forgot where it was located. It was like Florida somewhere. But they had a old helicopter that, you know, them having to fly somewhere always played somewhere into every episode. And it was this big helicopter with this giant monster mouth printed on the front of it. They called the Screaming Mimi, and they had a robot. It was like the most ridiculous premise for a TV show. I'm not even sure how long it was on, but yeah, like that's one of those things that you like most people like do not. When you bring up Riptide, it was one of those that you know, kind of fell into the memory abyss, and no one ever remembers Riptide.
Well, I mean, it ran for less than 2 years, so I mean.
Yeah, it didn't have the run that like a Magnum or a Simon and Simon did.
No, absolutely. You know, and
I think it came on like after A-Team for a while or something. Because like, I remember it being one of those that I found like after I was watching something else, and then that came on.
And I don't know. I think I was watching. I forgot what I was watching, but it was actually the old reruns that had debuted on USA Network after the cancellation or something. So
that's where a lot of that stuff. Because USA when it first came out just played a lot of reruns of old 80s stuff. But yeah, MacGyver. I mean, has anything had as a big impact on pulp culture as far as the technical show as MacGyver did? I mean, even today, when you're trying to modify something or fix something, you know, you're like,
I got a MacGyver. You still make the MacGyver reference.
Yeah. like duct tape will get you through anything. I mean, duct tape and a Swiss Army knife, that's all you need to conquer the world.
Wow. The Swiss Army knife. Man, I can remember the nostalgia, like, growing up as a kid, like, that was the, you know, hey, I've achieved something in life when, you know, you open the box and your parents have got you your first Swiss Army knife and you've got the saws and the scissors.
Yeah, they even eventually released one called the MacGyver and it had like 30 tools. It was ridiculous. It was way bigger than the one he had on the show. They put like every single tool they could think of into the MacGyver special. But yeah, I mean, there was always the segment in the A-Team show where they would get locked somewhere and then have to use whatever items laying around to build some kind of weird tank. And MacGyver, pretty much the same thing. You know, he didn't use a gun, so he was kind of like Batman, because, like, you know, he had, like, I think one of his friends accidentally got killed or something with a gun, so he's like, I don't use guns, but I'll build something to blow you up out of, you know, spare parts, but it's technically not a gun.
Have you guys ever played with Tannerite?
Yeah.
It makes a hell of a boom.
I mean, that's like, I think that was like the whole like first season of Mythbusters with them testing like MacGyverisms. Like that, like I said, that, like, not only do we make MacGyver references, everyone makes MacGyver references. There was even that comedy skit based on MacGyver, MacGruber, that was popular on Saturday Night Live. But yeah, they're probably responsible for Mythbusters. Anytime they ran out of ideas, they're like, let's look at an old MacGyver episode. I'll give us something to try.
Absolutely. That or, you know, somebody on YouTube or somewhere that's, you know, MacGyvered something and like, all right, that's got to be a hoax. Can that actually work?
Yeah, I mean, MacGyver is actually a verb now. I mean, it's probably in Webster's Dictionary. I mean, anytime you're going to try to fix something by, you know, unconventional means, it's you're MacGyvering it.
Well, I mean, we've got a fucking twerk in the dictionary and a whole other host of words.
If twerk is in the dictionary, MacGyver's not, I'm going to be pissed. I'm writing an angry letter right now to Webster's.
Do it.
I mean, Richard Dean Anderson, too. I mean, he later went on to do 10 seasons of freaking Stargate. I mean, the dude is awesome. It's not even going from a character that never used guns to a, you know, military guy that was shooting stuff up all the time.
Yeah, I don't know. I just had to throw it out there. I mean, it was one of the ones that I ran across during my research. I found a few episodes, so I wanted to make sure that it got its due justice.
Oh, that reminds me. He always had his, like, weird buddy that would show up every once in a while that was always getting him into shit, who was kind of the shady con man dude who was also a pilot. And that character, any episode where he was on was always a good episode because he was, like, kind of the buddy that, you know, you couldn't get rid of, but he was always getting you into trouble.
Huh, I feel like I got a buddy like that.
Hey, don't talk about Kevin like that.
I'm sorry.
I deny it's me. Oh, trust me, I have a beard. And speaking of 80s nostalgia, I tried to watch that remake, or the new Full House. Oh, it's so bad. Nostalgia can only take you so far.
I don't know. Like, I, you know, several of my female friends really enjoyed it.
I made it through about 10 minutes, and I was like, I had to pull the plug. I was like, nope, can't do it. The only thing that kept me through those 10 minutes is the girl that played Stephanie grew up really hot. But other than that, I was like, eventually the nostalgia wore off, and I'm like, I gotta go. But some of the people I work with is like, nah, you gotta, it gets better, like, in the next couple, like, the first episode's hard to watch, but, you know, give it another shot. So I may try it again because I hear it gets better in the following episodes. But yeah, that first episode was just nostalgia overload. But like I said, as we talk about MacGyver, you know, there was several shows that kind of were on the borderline of being a detective show, but were, you know, kind of, you know, putting a square peg in a round hole, kind of fit that category. And probably one of my favorites is, like I said, you know, we already talked about Knight Rider kind of falling into that kind of edge category, but Airwolf. I mean, that's Stringfellow Hawk and Dominic Santini, which was also kind of like Fall Guy because they were stunt pilots. You know, they would do these, like, you know, aerial stunt stuff, and then, you know, at night they secretly worked for, you know, some kind of CIA or whatever, and did missions with this super high tech badass helicopter called Airwolf that they stole from the CIA. Because like that was like
dun dun dun.
Because basically, Stringfellow Hawk, if you don't remember, his brother was a MIA, and so he was like one of the original test pilots on this thing before he left, and then the designer of Airwolf turned bad and stole the helicopter to basically become a mercenary. So they hire Hawk, because he's the only guy that can fly the thing, or is trained to fly it, to steal it back. And once he steals it back, he decides, I'm going to keep it for myself and kind of hold it for ransom. He's like, hey, I will do missions for you, but you've got to find what happened to my brother. So that's basically, they said they kept the Airwolf hidden inside this, like, because in this, like, volcano or plant, it was like inside of a mountain, like their own little bat cave. And then him and Dom would go off and run missions and fight communists and whatever, because this was the 80s, so it was always like Russian bad guys. Russian or the Chinese. But yeah, this helicopter had missiles, machine guns, all stuff. And it was basically Bell, it was some kind of Bell helicopter. Like, every once in a while you'll see them, because the wheels actually fold up inside them, and they got kind of like these little wings on the sides. So every time you see one, you're like, oh shit, that's Airwolf. Which the original Airwolf, after the show ended, it became a ambulance helicopter.
Really?
Yep. And I believe it eventually crashed and, yeah, killed the crew it was in. But yeah, that's after the show, it actually, you know, went from saving lives in fictional to saving lives in real life.
That is awesome. I don't know, man. I would love to find a, like, TV car museum, even if it was replicas or something, just to, you know, be able to relive some of the nostalgia that we've talked about.
Well, there is one up in Gatlinburg called Star Cars I've been to, and they have a lot of cool cars from here. That's where I saw Ecto-1. They had Ecto-1. They had one of the General Lees. They had the old 80s Batmobile. They had the 60s Batmobile. I mean, it was pretty badass. Badass car. I mean, badass museum.
Yeah, I would like to, you know, just go experience, have an opportunity to take some pictures. But I don't know, man. I mean, there's just so much nostalgia that we've talked about that, you know, I'm finding myself gravitating to, I guess. You look like you're in deep thought.
I'm trying to, like, it's a Bell 222A was the type of helicopter Airwolf was based on.
Yeah, I don't know. You ever flew in a helicopter? Crazy experience.
Yeah, I took one of those, like, little helicopter tours. So, like I said, why do you, like I said, is there any, like I said, out of is there anything that we haven't talked about that you remember that?
Let's see here. I mean, I don't know. You've kind of got Charlie's Angels that sort of fit in that mix.
Yeah,
but
that's like I said, I think the 80s was the heyday, but it really, like, you know, started blowing up back in the 70s with Charlie's Angels, you know, Hardcastle McCormick, The Rockford Files. You know, Columbo was a police drama, but I mean, you could even really call Matlock and a detective show. I
think that one, and then, you know,
what was the other lawyer show? It had Orson Welles.
Oh, shit.
Something with an M. But yeah, it like I said, it
not Matlock.
No. Yeah, the Rocker Files was you know, like I said, one of the ones from the 70s that was big.
Let's see here. You know, Moonlighting.
Moonlighting.
Yep.
I mean, without Moonlighting, we would never had Die Hard. That's where we, you know, Bruce Willis became famous. Was Moonlighting.
And then I think another big one, you know, Murder, She Wrote. I mean, that was...
Yes. I mean, that's one people still talk about today.
Well, I mean, dude, that thing ran for, what, 12 years?
Like... Yeah, something like that. I mean, and it kind of like, you know, reference to Agatha Christie and stuff. It was about a, you know, author that, you know, solved crimes on her. And it's basically, well, I would even say kind of Castle is almost like a modern remake. Instead of Murder, She Wrote, it's Murder, He Wrote.
Yeah. I mean, that definitely makes, you know, then Remington Still is another one that kind of comes to mind.
Yeah, I mean, the future Mr. Bond, Pierce Brosnan. I mean, that's where kind of he got his, what made him famous. Yeah, like I said, you could talk all day about the detective genre and not cover, you know, half of it. And I'd kind of like to see a return to that. Like it, like I said, it, you know, in the 90s, there was a lot of like low budget ones. Like I remember Renegade and a few others. But yeah, it kind of died out in the mid 90s and was replaced by the detective, you know, police dramas. But yeah, like I said, nowadays, like I said, you might, like we said, Supernatural, Castle, but there's very, you know, I always loved Burn Notice when it was on. That was probably the closest thing to an actual, you know, detective show we've had lately. Mike Hammer back in the day, Hardcastle McCormick. But, you know, as we wrap it up, do you have a particular favorite?
I mean, A-Team is still going to be it, you know, but... You know, MacGyver definitely has a big place. You know, I've always loved trying to, you know, be hands-on, think outside of the box, and, you know, try to problem solve. And that's one of the things that MacGyver, you know, was big on. Yep, and then
creative problem solving.
And then, you know, Magnum P.I. is another big one. Those are the three that, you know, I'm really finding myself gravitating back to.
Yeah, I think, like I said, for me, it's like I loved all those shows, but probably the one I watched the most of was Simon and Simon and Fall Guy, which Fall Guy had probably one of the best opening theme songs as well, sung by Lee Majors. You know, you don't get too many theme songs sung by the actor, you know, up until, you know, Chuck Norris sung Walker Texas Ranger theme. Yeah. When in Texas, look behind you, because that's where the Ranger's going to be.
Once again. Hat, boots.
Yeah, I mean, that Fall Guy theme song.
And his truck was almost as nostalgic as Chuck Norris himself.
Yeah. I mean, he did have that Dodge Ram that was, you know, very close to Colt Seaver's truck. But yet, the song is called The Lonely Stuntman. Like, look it up on YouTube. It's all about, you know, how he does all this stuff, but he never gets any... No one knows who he is. He's like, I'm the most famous guy in Hollywood that you don't know my name. He's like, you know, all my leading... You know, I'm always bandaging my knee while my leading ladies are kissing other men. He does, you know, he does the scene that makes, you know, whoever look really badass, and then he has to leave when, you know, gets to the love scene.
Yeah, that's when I shelter my eyes.
And as we wrap up this cigar, any final thoughts before we move on?
Man, I feel like I kind of gave my final thoughts, you know, on the initial review. I mean, budget friendly. Full flavor profile, and I mean, as far as the construction, the aroma, and I mean, this is just an overall very good, inexpensive smoke that I don't think has received a lot of publicity. So if you're a full-bodied smoker, I would highly encourage you to check out the Punch Signature if you haven't smoked it already.
And it stays real consistent throughout, too. There's not a lot of... drop off in the strength or flavor. You pretty much get a good solid smoke from beginning
to end.
And I mean,
every one that I've had has been, you know, just spot on consistent. And I mean, that's one of the big things. Like I have not smoked a lot of Punch cigars, but if you look at people's feedback and, you know, the ratings of the company overall, that is one of the biggest things they're known for, is that consistency and the quality of product.
Yeah, other than this one, the uppercut's about the only other punch I've had, and yeah, so there I've not been disappointed with any of the punches I've had so far.
Perfect. All right.
And with that, we'll be right back with the next segment.
Stay tuned.
Well, I'm not the kind to kiss and tell, but I've been seen with fire up. I've never been with anything less than a nine. So fine. I've been on fire with Sally Field, gone fast with a girl named Bo. But somehow they just don't end up as mine. It's a death-defying life I lead. I take my chances. I die for a living in the movies and TV. But the hardest thing I ever do is watch my leading ladies kiss some other guy while I'm bandaging my knee. I might fall from a tall building. I might roll a brand new car. Cause I'm the unknown stuntman that made Redford such a star.
That time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. It's Beer 30. Pour them if you got them. What are we drinking this week, Brad?
We're drinking a collaboration between Boulevard Brewing Company and Sierra Nevada Brewing Company called Terra Incognita.
Which translate into unknown earth or unknown land.
Yeah, this is really an interesting beer. I mean, with this one here, you're 13% L, and it's 55% L aged in wine barrels, and then 32% aged in bourbon barrels.
Yeah, this is their third version of this beer. This has kind of been an annual collaboration for the two companies, since they both kind of sit at either end of the California Trail. It's their, you know, road trip beer, I guess.
Yeah, it's a lot fruitier. I mean, it is very earthy. I mean, in its profile, almost drinks like a barley wine from the, you know, fruit aspects of the beer, but it doesn't have that warming, like sensational, yeah, you know, high alcohol. You know, this comes in at, I think it is 9.8% ABV, so... You know, it's just not as alcohol tasting as a lot of barley wines, but it definitely has that fruit aspect.
It definitely has like the definitely pick up the wine flavoring, which is kind of weird, but yeah, it's unexpected, but it's actually not unenjoyable.
I mean, and it's, I don't know. I mean, it's definitely got a distinctive flavor. You know, it's very complex. I mean, I don't know, you know, folks that are wine drinkers may appreciate this, you know, for more of this aspect, more so than us as beer drinkers. But I mean, you don't have any kind of real hop bitterness or anything. I mean, it's just a smooth, complex, rich, earthy beer. I mean,
yeah, very, like I said, very floral tasting. It tastes like a wine that's been carbonated.
Yeah, I mean, it's
still got that beer, you know, carbonation. But yeah, it just definitely tastes more like a wine than me than a beer.
I don't know. I mean, I would definitely be, you know, curious to try this with a, you know, a nice steak or something to that extent. You know, the color here is just magnificent. You know, definitely got an amber to brown hue, and yeah, you know, just
dark red, almost brown.
Yeah, I mean, so overall, you know, from appearance, from, you know, taste and everything else, I think I'm probably at about a 4 on this beer.
Yeah, I think I'll agree with you this week. Follow along on your Untappd app.
Absolutely. Get those pictures uploaded. All right. Any other final thoughts?
Pick one up. Pretty good beer.
Perfect. Awesome. Stay tuned.
And welcome back to Science. It's time to learn some stuff. You ready to learn some stuff, Brad?
Yeah, man. What you got?
Well, space. The final frontier.
I feel like we've talked a lot about space.
Space and robots. That's what the show has turned into. How does space affect your body is what we're talking about today. Recently, astronaut Scott Kelly returned from a 340-day mission in the International Space Station. And yeah, spending that much time in space actually has a lot of effect on your body. And that's one of the things was kind of cool is what makes this a unique opportunity to study. Because, you know, eventually, like we said, we're trying to plan a manned Mars mission, which, so they're trying to study how, because it's going to take a lot longer to get there than it is to get to Earth's, you know, orbit. So, you know, having to study what an extended period of time in space is going to do to you. Scott Kelly is actually a twin. So, you know, we're able to compare, you know, because theoretically they were both exactly the same when Scott left. So now they can compare what's happened to him versus his brother that was here on Earth for the last year and see how this time and space maybe have differentiated them a little bit.
I don't know. I mean, I haven't necessarily looked at the article, but I would say one of probably the biggest things would be like a weight difference. Like for me anyway, and my eating habits, like there's so much convenience and, oh, I'm just going to get a snack in the middle of the night or blah, yeah, blah, blah. Like you don't really have that luxury when, you're not on the planet.
Another thing too is, you know, your body is built to function in a gravity state. That's why your bones are as strong as they are. That's why you have muscle mass. You know, spending a year or more in a, you know, weightless environment, astronauts lose up to 40% of their muscles. Even their bones tend to weaken during the time and space, and they even produce less blood because it's not, you know, as necessary when you're not having to walk around. That's why they have to spend like 2.5 hours a day exercising just to maintain a little bit of muscle mass. You know, even with that, they're still losing that 40% of muscle mass, you know, during a mission. So yeah, there's definitely you know, a lot that happens to your body when you're in space. Another thing too is the space station is kind of in the it's kind of on the outer edge of the Earth magnetic field. So there is some shielding to space radiation, but they also receive 40 times the dose of radiation that you get here on a daily basis, or, you know, in the same time on Earth. So cancer is a real, you know, threat to you know, someone who spends a lot of time in space. And, you know, once you get outside of that protective area of the Earth, like you would, because it's going to be like a 180-day mission to get from here to Mars. And they say with that, you would end up absorbing 100 times more radiation than you do here on Earth.
That's crazy. So do we know, you know, like what the, you know, short or long, like I'm just wondering, like, you know, could it increase the likelihood of cancers and, you know, stuff to that effect, or
that's what they're saying, is that there's definitely a, you know, astronauts are definitely at a higher risk of cancer and early onset Alzheimer's due to space exposure. So that's one thing that's going to have to be talked about and, you know, overcome in any kind of long term deep space mission. So that, and like I said, since we have a twin to experiment on, kind of compare the differences there.
What is his age? Do you know?
I don't know. I'd say probably in his 40s, something from the looks of him. Either that or space just really put some age on you.
I would just be curious, you know, to see, you know, what a lot of the long-term effects truly are.
Yeah, because that's definitely something that's going to have to be addressed before we spend any great length of time in space. And watching some of the videos of how they exercise in space, too, is hilarious, because there's no gravity. So basically, they're strapped down to a treadmill on, you know, with the bungee cords that kind of simulates, you know, gravity.
I'm looking at that image now. That's interesting. I mean, but I mean, when there's no gravity, I mean, what else are you going to do to create friction and, you know, to have a little bit of resistance?
Yeah, it's not like you're going to be able to, you know, bench press in space.
Watch me.
I'm going to get swole, yo.
I don't know about swole, but you know what? I'm going to have a never-ending max.
Oh, and do you like black metal?
Yeah, I like my coffee black like my metal.
Well, scientists discovered a new blacker metal. The blackest black in existence. They call it Vanta Black.
Is it Duncan Hill's coffee?
Yeah, this stuff absorbs 99.965% of light. So it's like I said, it's, you would not want to make a ninja outfit out of this, because you would stand out in the darkness of night, because you would be even blacker than the blackest night.
Well, I mean, you know, that's one of the you know, things that I read was, a lot of people think, oh, I should wear solid black, but a dark red is actually, you know, more camouflage than a solid black in most instances.
I've always found gray, like a good faded black, was always a good for sneaking around in. Yeah, I'm not going to say what I was sneaking around doing. I once freaking
picking daffodils. That's a good one.
Mike actually bought a ninja suit one time at this gift shop we found it in called China Bazaar in Gatlinburg. And we were staying in a cabin, and that little bastard put on his ninja outfit and ran out into the woods. And it was like, gone for a little while. I'm like, where the hell is he? And I'm looking out the window, looking around, trying to see where he's at. And all of a sudden, I notice like two eyes, like right there up against the glass, staring at me. Scare the shit out of me. But a ninja outfit apparently does work. Because I'm like, the hell did you come from?
So if the eyes gave it away, what would you do? I guess, you know, some dark contact lenses or something?
Punch a fool in the face. I know, you need the visor like Snake Eyes just to finish up the fully blacking out. Or you could use an invisibility cloak like the Robot Chameleon. Yeah, back to robot news.
Robot Chameleon. Holy shit, it is a robot chameleon. Wow.
Yeah, and they're saying the technology they develop in this may lead to invisibility cloaks. Scientists...
Great. So no matter all the... Now the robots are going to be fucking invisible. Great.
Yeah, Wuhan University in China has built this robot chameleon using something they call biometallic nanodot array, which basically allows the, you know, thing to change color to match whatever, you know, background is in front of it. It's like I said, in to test this, they actually built a little robot chameleon. And it even has, like, you know, the fully articulating eyes that can, you know, look at the background behind it and then match its body panels to match that background in real time. So yeah, it's, you know, as things changes, it changes its body to match. The scales are made of a thin glass, and the using the nanodot arrays and electrochemical bias, yeah, whatever that is. To confirm,
this thing looks like a freaking Rubik's cube.
Yeah, it's got all kind of little scales, but yet, I mean, eventually this technology could be, you know, harnessed for, like I said, camouflage systems, you know, on the battlefield, turning you know, weapons, soldiers, whatever, invisible.
Do you like Skynet? Because this is how we get Skynet.
Yeah, like, we have to deal with the Terminators are bad enough. Yes. Now we get invisible Terminators.
Like, now people are going to be like, oh, look at here, let's test the balance of the iguanas, or, you know, chameleons, and start, you know, pushing them over and shit, and they're going to turn invisible, and I think we're getting in over our heads. Like, we are creating, you know, we are no longer going to be the dominant predator of the Earth.
Speaking of the predator, I mean, this is what they're developing. Yeah,
it doesn't have dreads yet.
Yeah, I mean, this technology, you're having a Harry Potter invisibility cloak. It's kind of cool. I mean, it reminds me of some of the old video games where, you know, there'd be the stealth soldiers and stuff, and you'd be like, why's that thing shimmering? Oh, no, it's shooting at me now. Crap, there's something there.
That or, you know, the brutes are, you know, I think it was the brutes on Halo that were invisible. Like, the only thing that gave them away was the energy sword, and by the time you saw it, you were dead.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah, it's yeah, scary technology in the wrong hands. But then again, I wouldn't have to worry about washing my car as much. I could just, you know, let it change color to...
What's that going to do for auto accidents? I'm sorry, sir. He forgot to decloak his car, so I just smashed through it.
Oh. Hashtag drive-by.
Yes. I think that's a different kind of drive-by that he was referring to.
But one last thing on the kind of a sad note to science. Recently, we had our last episode of the Mythbusters.
Yeah, man, I was not ready for, you know, this series to be over with. I mean, dude, I don't know when the Mythbusters started, but I feel like they've been, you know, like a
2003
decade.
To 2016, 15 seasons, 300 episodes. You know, originally starting, you know, Adam Savage, Jamie Heidemann, and they eventually added the B team of Cary Byron, Grant Imahara, and Tori Belleci. And like I said, this kind of, I mean, one of the reasons this show is so important, and you know, so it brought science back to the mainstream. I mean, there's been a kind of a, you know, history of dumbing down of America, and science education is, you know, not as important. Exploration has not been as important. And Mythbusters really brought, it was cool to be a scientist again. I mean, and these guys were, you know, Hollywood special effects guys, and you know, some of the most creative things that, you know, make connecting science to pop culture by, you know, trying to, you know, recreate these, you know, big Hollywood sequences and stuff to see if they, you know, could actually be done in real life. But yeah, that's kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to include a science segment in our podcast is just, you know, science is something important that everyone should learn. I mean, it's, you know, we don't have guys striving to be astronauts and, you know, scientists anymore. And that's, you know, kind of going to be detrimental to society in the long run when people are getting their knowledge from Facebook and Wikipedia and social media instead of learning shit.
I thought one of the biggest benefits of the Mythbusters is it dared to ask why. Yeah. Or
why the fuck not?
Exactly. So it challenged the mainstream perception, and it put it into tangible evidence of, you know, is this plausible? Is it absolutely true? Or is it absolutely fake? And, you know, to your point, I don't find too many people challenging and just asking why.
Yeah.
You know, and without that question and without an answer, like, are you truly operating on fact, or are you just taking things at face value? And that leads to a dangerous society, in my opinion, you know, when nobody questions and, you know, just the government says this and that. I mean, shit, we're 1984, George Orwell. Guess what? Big Brother's got us.
I mean, there is legit people that believe, that doesn't realize Titanic was a true story. Or was based on a true story.
They don't
realize a ship really sank. Like, I mean, there's just too many people that have learned far too much from social media and pop culture.
Don't pick up a book
or even Google something.
You know, unfortunately, like what I found is with a lot of college professors and, you know, even going into elementary, middle, and high school even, is you're not necessarily taught based on fact. You're taught based on whatever that professor or that teacher's perception, and you're taught their opinion more so than the cold, hard, black and white fact of true or false.
Yeah. I mean, even there's so many times where I'm like, something will pop up and I'm like, huh, I wonder about that. And now we have smartphones. I mean, you can go right to Google and learn about whatever topic. But there's so many people now that are just too lazy to do any kind of, you know, research.
Well, I mean, it just, I don't know. You know, I'm not going to necessarily pick on sports fanatics or anything, but it boggles my mind the some of the friends that I have that can quote off every stat of every football team, every player, but they can't tell you one thing about what's going on in the world today. Like, you know, and the same with, like, reality TV shows. Like, is that your reality? Because it's damn sure not mine. So to me, that is not a reality TV show.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I so loved about the show was that it really showed the scientific method. I mean, they come up with a problem that they needed to test, and you know, they showed you the whole process of figuring out the best way to test that theory, you know, and design an experiment that, you know, to prove or test whatever fact there were, you know. And speaking of, to tie it back to the earlier topic, these were the modern day MacGyvers. I mean, you know, they not only showed you the test, they showed you what all the went into designing that test, and it really took some out of the box thinking to build some of these contraptions and stuff to make a, you know, correct test and, you know, do a control experiment, and also to blow shit up. That was one of the best. I mean, if you love explosions, this was a show for explosions, because they'd be like, all right, we want to test this theory. We've tested this theory as it was shown and it failed. Now let's show you what it would take to actually accomplish what, you know, we were trying to accomplish, which usually means adding a whole bunch of C4 or whatever. Like, I think one of the funniest episodes where they're like, oh yeah, you can throw a stick of dynamite in a cement truck to break loose cement. That didn't work. So they're like, all right, let's see how much explosive force we would need to put in to see how to get the cement out of a cement truck. And then they exploded the cement truck. There was nothing left of it.
Yes.
Like, yeah, I think we used a little bit too much explosives there.
Oops. But, I mean, I don't know, man.
I would like to see a number on the amount of explosives used in those 300 episodes. They probably added up to a nuclear bomb at this point.
Probably so. I don't know. I'd definitely be... That would be an interesting statistic to have.
Yeah, I mean, it was... Oh, it, like I said, it was a great show. Sad to see it go. Yeah, but, yeah, science education, I don't know. I mean, is hopefully, very important.
Hopefully with the Netflixes, the Amazons, and the YouTubes of the world, you know, hopefully it can carry on. And,
yeah, last I checked, Mythbusters was on Netflix, so definitely, yeah, go and catch up on 15 years of
and
of
even education. Though, you know, Mythbusters is over, I mean, I've still seen, you know, Carrie and Grant on some other episodes and stuff, not necessarily, you know, Mythbusters related, but they've been on, you know, the Travel Channel and stuff of that nature. So who knows what kind of shows that this might open the door for later on.
And now as things go farther and farther away from traditional media, YouTube is the place to go for your science. I mean, there's so many weird YouTube channels with guys doing crazy experiments and whatnot. So, you know, if you can't get a Mythbusters on network TV, you know, go fall down some YouTube holes. There's plenty of guys doing cool stuff on YouTube.
But there's a lot of people doing a lot of stupid shit, too.
Like Zombie Go Boom. Yes. Oh, yeah. If you want to know if a dildo will kill a zombie, go look up that episode.
Can you not say, hey, earmuffs or something? You know what I mean? Jeez.
Oh, and with that, we'll wrap it up and be right back.
Stay tuned.
We are the Metal Geeks Podcast, and on this show, we have heavy metal, comic books, video games, movies, theme parks, and more.
Wait, comics?
Yep.
And movies?
Exactly.
Video games?
Yeah.
Metal?
Of course.
How does theme parks fit in this?
It just does. All of us Metal Geeks can be found at MetalGeeks.net.
At Metal Geeks for Twitter.
Metal Geeks on Instagram.
And Metal Geeks on the Facey Space. You can also find us on iTunes. Subscribe today.
Metal Geeks.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News.
Yeah.
Feels like a long time since I did this segment. I don't know what's going on.
You say that every week.
I know. That's weird, right?
There's only 2 weeks between segments. It's not that long.
It feels like a really, really long time. So up first, we've got J.J. Abrams, and he says he has bigger plans for the whole Cloverfield franchise. It was originally anticipated that, you know, the 10 Cloverfield Lane would be the last of the films, but apparently that's not necessarily true. JJ says it's not an anthology. It's something they've been working on, but it will remain to be seen if we're getting the shot to do it. So
yeah, that, the trailers for that looked very creepy. I mean, John Goodman, like I said, it's like got a very claustrophobic people that kind of living in a bunker of sorts. And like, you really don't know if he's crazy or if there's monsters outside.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I mean, the Cloverfield films, I mean, they're really interesting and rather intriguing because you don't always know what the foe is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the first Cloverfield was, you know, kind of harkened back to Blair Witch. It was like the found footage shot, you know, by the people in the movie. And it's the first time we really saw that in a Godzilla-esque, you know, monster movie shot from the perspective of the people on the streets instead of a, you know, third person's perspective like most movies would be. So, but yeah, sometimes those shaky cam videos are just hard to watch. If you suffer from motion sickness, it they can tear you up. But yeah, this Cloverfield Lane does not do the shaky cam thing from the original, so it looks a little safer.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm really curious to see what the future does hold for the franchise. And it's, like you said, you know, there's definitely been a change in the way that the films are shot, you know, as far as kind of that, you know, first-hand shaky camera type thing to now, you know.
Yeah, from the looks of it, the girl that's in it basically, I guess, has a car accident and then wakes up in this bunker. These guys, you know, I guess saved her or whatever. And she doesn't know, her like, this dude crazy and holding me hostage? Or is there really something that he's trying to protect me from? And it's that whole balance of, you know, the paranoia of, do these people really have my best interests at heart? Or is this all bullshit? Yeah.
I mean, definitely a question that, you know, one has to ask themselves. And I don't know. I'm really looking forward to seeing the film myself. So, you know, I've liked the other films. So we'll just have to see what the future has in store.
Still got that Private Eye song stuck in my head.
Yeah. Man, that's the thing, man. Those songs are so catchy. Hall & Oates, Private Eye. Yes. Well, something else has been stuck in my head and has been kind of a recurring theme of Nerd News is, who the fuck is Tom Holland?
We finally see him.
Yeah, and I've seen Tom Holland.
For all of like 10 seconds or whatever reason, the newest Captain America trailer that dropped earlier this week.
Yeah, and so we're talking about the new Captain America trailer and Spider-Man's debut, and it's kind of odd seeing this version of the Spider-Man costume.
Yeah, because when I first saw it, I'm like, man, that looks weird. It's not, it looked way, like, flatter. Like, it almost looked, you know, totally CGI, but then as I looked at it closely, it's, you know, if you're used to seeing the Spider-Man costumes from the last couple movies, this is a throwback to Silver Age Spider-Man. This is the costume, or based on the costume from the 60s and 70s Spider-Man. You know, if you remember the old Spider-Man cartoon that were the whole, like, Spider-Man song. That's the costume with the cartoonish-looking spider on the back and the little tiny spider on the chest piece. It's, you know, basically based off those original Steve Ditko drawings. Even the eyes, which were the weirdest part because they moved. I'm like, why is his eyes animated?
Yeah. But then,
like, after you watch it, you notice it's like there's a metallic motor sound to it. So it's
almost like that StarTech.
It's obviously some kind of, like, you know, so, you know, Tony's kind of upgraded his suit or something, given some lenses.
But I mean, I gotta say, as a whole, man, this trailer was pretty insane. I mean, it was, you know.
Oh yeah, this is gonna have some action.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you see, you know, Cap sitting around and they're watching, you know, what happened, you know, with New York and a lot of the other major cities and all of the destruction, and, you know, you see the helicarrier crashing and everything. I mean, there's,
and then, you know, the stuff from Age of Ultron with the you know, the whole destroying that whole city pretty much.
Yes. You know, so, you know, with this one, you know, the government's, do we need superheroes? Are these guys actually good? You know, the collateral damage suffered is, you know, does that outweigh the initial threat?
And yeah, because anybody who read the original Civil War storyline, that was all about, you know, superheroes giving up their secret identity and registering with the government, which we can't really do that storyline because no one other than, you know, now that they've introduced Spider-Man, really has a secret identity in the modern MCU. So it's more about, does superheroes need some kind of government oversight to hopefully prevent the destruction that they, you know, at this point they're like, are they helping or are they causing as much damage as the foes they're fighting?
Absolutely. So I don't know, man. I found this trailer pretty riveting, and, you know, one of the things is, you know, Tom Holland making his appearance at Spider-Man, like, the voice, to me, you know, was almost exactly Tobey Maguire-ish.
Yeah, because they're definitely going with a younger, high school-aged Spider-Man, and I like how Tony Stark calls him Underoos.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the whole, you know, he's faced off Team Cap versus Team Iron Man, and finally he's like, I've had enough of this. Underoos, go. And, like, freaking, all of a sudden Spider-Man snatches his shield and then lands. He's like, hey, guys.
So, you know, now we know we have Spectacular Spider-Man. So.
And that scene of Ant-Man flying on one of Hawkeye's arrows, that's straight out of a comic book cover. I mean, that's... There were so many, like, just scenes that you could draw straight from the pages of Marvel. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to this. And, you know, of course, you know, Tony, I guess, probably feels guilty about what happened because basically the whole Ultron thing is his fault. So he's definitely all for we should have somebody limiting us so we don't create monsters ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be kind of that delicate, you know, check and balance, if you will. So I don't know. We'll just have to, you know, see.
And I do like the Iron Man watch that when he gets attacked by Winter Soldier, he's able to pull out a little Iron Man glove and catch a bullet. It's going to be sweet. I mean, this is basically Avengers 2.5 or something, because there's just pretty much, with the exception of Hulk and Thor, it looks like the entire team is back.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things. I don't know. I was, you know, cruising the internet, and one of the funnier things that I ran across was a meme that showed, you know, Spider-Man making his entrance, and it immediately cut over to Daredevil, and he's like, oh, look, he did the superhero landing.
Oh, you mean Deadpool?
Or Deadpool, yes.
I saw one. It was such a freaking troll. Someone's like, you know, leaked footage of Spider-Man fighting Ant-Man, and it's like a scene from one of the old, like, Spider-Man movies, like the pre-Tobey Maguire, like the early 80s, like, Spider-Man. And he's, like, hammering at something with a wrench. And so you don't see what he's, like, trying to hit with a wrench, and he's like, it's secret footage of him fighting Ant-Man.
That's awesome.
Some freaking trolls.
So, something that isn't necessarily a troll, something that is far, far from your heart, is we got the new Ghostbuster trailer.
Yes.
And your thoughts, sir?
I mean, up until now, I've complained about this movie, and people are like, dude, you haven't seen anything yet. How can you hate it? Now I have evidence. I'm like, this is why I hate this. I mean, it's going to suck so hard. And, you know, like I said, I was talking with some people, and they're like, well, if you don't compare it to the original, it has the potential to be a good movie. And I'm like, yeah, it looks like a really amazing Saturday Night Live skit. Like, it looks like a parody of the Ghostbusters and not the Ghostbusters. If they were building this as, like, a freaking parody movie, fine. But, yeah, building this as the Ghostbusters, I hate it so much because it's... The Ghostbusters was never silly. I mean, it was funny, but the characters took the world and everything seriously. And the comedy came from the ridiculousness and the one-liners. This one looks like typical... of these actresses, which I've enjoyed a lot of their other movies. I think they are you know, have made some great funny movies, but their typical brand of humor is the silly slapsticky style of humor, and I don't want to see that on my Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm right there with you. You know, this is nothing. You know, not a slight against actresses, or you know. Saying that, oh, it's not a male role, this shouldn't be a thing.
No, if this was four guy Saturday Night Live actors doing the same shit, I would still hate it. It has nothing to do with the sex of the characters. It's the style of movie they're making that offends me.
This is Joe. Joe is offended.
I mean, I'll still see it just so I can make fun of it. But
I mean, we're cigar nerds. We have to see it. It just comes with the territory.
Yeah, it's
just, we got to take the good with the bad.
We can't make fun of it on the podcast unless we go see it. So, like, I will go see it. I probably might not see it opening weekend, but because I don't want to encourage him to make another one.
Well, let's move on to a brighter topic. The EW has Flash, Arrow, DC's Legends of Tomorrow, and iZombie renewed. And I gotta say that I'm ecstatic for all of these shows. I am absolutely digging Legends of Tomorrow. I guess maybe because I'm such a Doctor Who fan, but you mix Doctor Who with a little bit of the superheroes, and dude, it's right up my alley.
Yeah, Captain Cold Stark is probably turned into one of my favorite characters on this show. I mean, he's the one that's kind of gone through so much of a... story arc of being the bad guy. Now he's, you know, pretty much embracing a hero, you know, even though he tries to maintain his hard edge and but you know, it's kind of bleeding through that, you know, I actually believe I can do some good.
Yeah, and you know, I love some of the, you know, kind of the crossover they're doing, you know, introducing Arrow in episode 6 and
yeah, future Arrow.
You know, now you've got, you know, Kevin Smith, who is he still directing? Or
I think they're working on filming it now because I've seen him posting some stuff on Facebook from like the whatever pre-production stuff. But yeah, he's going to be directing an episode of Flash later this season. So I'm interested to see what he can do in the in the genre.
And I mean, you know, if you guys, you know, most people and everybody recognizes Kevin Smith from Clerks, and you know,
some be a lot of talking in that episode.
Will recognize. I'm wondering if we're going to have a Kevin Smith cameo.
Oh, I so yes. Want to see like Jay and Bob hanging out in front of a Star City, you know, gas station or something, and Flash just go by and they go like, "What the hell was that?"
Yes. You just see, you know, Bob over there just kind of nod silently in, you know, typical Kevin Smith fashion.
Oh.
But yeah, I gotta say, I'm excited that, you know, all of these, you know, shows are going to, you know, be renewed. And, I don't know, man, the EW has just done a phenomenal job, with their lineups.
Yeah. The DC Cinematic Universe, I've not been entirely a fan of, but the TV DC Universe is killing it. I mean, I think in the next couple weeks we're getting the Supergirl Flash crossover, and some of the promotional stuff they posted, that like recreating, you know, some old comic book covers. I'm excited to see those two characters get together.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because you don't see a whole lot of cross network crossovers anymore. So this is kind of cool that, you know, some people, the, you know, CBS and CW, yeah, kind of got together to to put this together.
Yeah. Switching gears a little bit. We've got Clayne Crawford cast as Riggs for Fox's Lethal Weapon.
Oh, yeah. I forgot they're doing a Lethal Weapon TV show.
Yeah. I am.
Getting too old for this shit.
I don't know. You know, I wonder how the dynamic between, you know, him and Damon Wayans, you know, senior is going to.
Damon Wayans is playing Murtaugh?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So I was just trying to think of who would be a good Murtaugh. I was thinking, Jeremy Delino, the detective from Gone in 60 Seconds. Like, he would make a good Murtaugh.
Yes. But I don't know. You know, this is a series that I'm interested in seeing what Fox ends up doing with it.
I mean, yeah, it's pretty much that movie was the creator of the buddy cop genre. So yeah, I'll give a TV version of that a shot.
And then up next is the Tick live action reboot gets a pilot order from Amazon. And I haven't seen anything related to the Tick since the, you know, old animated Tick that used to come Saturday morning cartoons, probably back in, you know, the probably early to mid 90s.
Yeah, there was a live action TV show that I've heard it got great reviews, but I've not actually seen any of it. I need to go find it online and watch it. But just seeing the visuals of the live action Tick was awesome. So yeah, I'm interested to see what Amazon can do. And Amazon, Netflix, Hulu, all these people have been killing it with their original series. I mean, they've, you know, gone from basically an online video rental to a legit network.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hell, we've got Daredevil about to happen again. And I can't say enough about, you know, the first season, much less what season two is going to hold.
Oh yeah, we'll
us.
Probably be nerd news next episode will probably be all about Daredevil, because that will be out between the next episode. Yeah, like I said, these you know, online and they don't have the limitations of network TV, so they can really get creative and just, you know, go all out. You know, it's amazing what I mean. It's going to get to the point where we're not going to have network TV anymore. It's all going to be online subscription services.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know. We'll just have to see, you know. And for the folks, wanted to get your thoughts on this. So the first Beetlejuice was really good. You know, thoroughly enjoyed the movie. There was a, you know, article circulating the internet and rumors that Beetlejuice 2 had been confirmed, which we have since learned is a fake.
yeah, because I saw it like posted by a legitimate site that was like, "Hey, it's been confirmed," and then later that day they're like, "Never mind, it wasn't confirmed."
Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of that fine balance between being on the cutting edge versus, you know, just getting misinformation. But
supposedly it's still in the works. It's something that still might happen. And I would like to see a return of that character. I mean, Keaton...
I thoroughly enjoyed...
...is still a great actor. I mean, that whatever Birdman movie he did was amazing. So yeah, I'd love to see them come back and try it again.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just be cautious what you see on the internet. But you know what? If there's enough people that can, you know, rally together and, you know, create the publicity and say, "Hey, we would love to see this actually happen," you know, I'm sure there's enough eyes and ears out there that, you know, will pick up on that response. So that's what I got for news.
All right. Follow us on CigarNerdPodcast.com. We're also members of the ESO Network at ESOPodcast.com. Pick up some shirts at RealMenSmokeCigars.com/CigarNerds. We have our Zazzle store, and links to all that stuff is on our website. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We're at CigarNerdPod. And 2 years ago, two podcasters were accused of a crime they didn't commit and immediately escaped into the DragonCon underground. Today, if you have a problem and no one else can help you, and if you can download them, you too can hire the Cigar Nerds. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.